We'll hear argument now in the case of the United States against Lefebvre.
Please the court, Joshua Block appearing on behalf of Anna Lefebvre. Instead of charging Ms. Lefebvre with identity fraud, the government charged her with aggravated identity theft. The difference between identity fraud and identity theft is that identity theft creates two victims: the victim whose money is stolen as part of the underlying crime, and the victim whose identity is stolen in order to make the crime happen. Because there are two victims, 1028A adds an additional 2 years on top of the defendant's sentence in order to account for the additional harm suffered by the second victim. That's why an essential element of aggravated identity theft is that the defendant must have used the means of identification of another person.
Is there a difference between property and identity? When it comes to how we think of theft from a person. In other words, when someone dies, she may no longer retain any property rights. But as the Eighth Circuit said in Kowal, she does retain an identity. So when we're dealing with a statute that criminalizes identity theft, isn't it appropriate to presume that the term person includes both living and dead persons unless the legislature says otherwise? I mean, that's really the bottom line here, and I'd kind of like to get to it because you don't have much time.
Sure. Well, actually, Your Honor, a good analogy might be the law of defamation or rights of publicity, and traditionally those rights terminate at death. At common law, you can't bring an action for defamation alleging that your deceased relative was defamed by a false statement. It's not a cause of action.
So do you think all 1983 suits have to be dismissed when the plaintiff dies because 1983 says any person injured, etc., can sue?
Yeah, Your Honor, there's a difference between the injury occurring while you're alive.
No. The word says any person who is injured can sue. Right. You may or may not know that this argument was actually presented to the Supreme Court in a 1983 case, and they held that deceased persons are still persons. It wasn't that a non-person can sue. Deceased persons are persons.
Well,
and so I shared Judge Rogner's question, why isn't a deceased, given that finding, why isn't a deceased person a person here too?
Well, Your Honor, they're persons in some contexts, but not in others, and especially if you're talking about 1983, your constitutional rights can't be infringed upon after you're dead. If your constitutional rights were infringed upon while you were alive, those rights survive and can be, under the federal rules, certain rights do survive and certain rights don't.
Now that's actually, there is no federal rule for survival. There are state laws on survival.
Well, and so some of
states allow wrongful death suits to survive and some don't. The question in the case I was mentioning was, what is the meaning of the word person?
Well, and that has to be determined based on the context of the statute and the plain meaning of the word person. And in the context of this statute, the Supreme Court has specifically instructed the courts are to look toward the common law of theft offenses in light of the statutory caption. And that is the body of law that's probably the most useful for this court. It's highly relevant that at common law, a traditional element of larceny was that property had to have been stolen from a living human being. And that remains true to this day, as the Ninth Circuit has held in a case also involving an identity theft statute. The Ninth Circuit held that an identity theft statute that purported to cover identities being stolen from a dead person fell outside the modern generic definition.
Let me ask you a different question. How do we know that the stepsister is dead? I understand your client's defense at trial. It was that the stepsister was and is alive and had committed the bank fraud herself. Now, there are two ways, given that defense, that the jury could have convicted your client. One is the conclusion which the prosecutor took, that the stepsister is dead. The other is the conclusion that the stepsister is alive, but your client is responsible for the fraud. So how is it that we could determine conclusively that the stepsister is dead?
Well, Your Honor, it's the government has to meet its burden of proof based on its own allegations. A trial shouldn't have even happened. The indictment should have been dismissed on its face, and if not that, there should have been granted the defendant's Rule 29 motion before the defendant made any argument whatsoever. In any event,
I don't understand that. Yeah. There are two possibilities. The stepsister is alive or the stepsister is dead. There's a way in which your client can be guilty on your own terms. That is, the stepsister is alive, but your client committed the fraud. So obviously you can't dismiss the indictment.
Well,
the jury wasn't given a special verdict and asked to find whether the stepsister is alive or dead. You're basically contradicting the position at trial and saying, you know, Emily Latella, never mind, now assume the opposite of my entire defense.
No, Your Honor, I think what you're suggesting is picking part of what the defendant's version of the facts were and part of what the government's version of the facts were and splicing them together. Under the defendant's version of the facts, the sister was alive, plus the defendant didn't misappropriate any identity whatsoever. So if the jury believed the defendant, the jury would have had to acquit on the facts. I don't think it's plausible that the jury believed all of the government's allegations and disbelieved everything that the defendant said except for the fact that the sister was still alive. In any event, it's impossible to waive an element of the defense. The government bears that burden of proof. If Ms. Lefebvre had tried to say, I plead guilty to this indictment, I'm not going to put on any defense whatsoever, the court would still have had to reject that plea for not being sufficient to meet all the elements of the defense. I think it's also important to look at the plain meaning of the term person when used in everyday English. Standing alone and without any modifiers, the word is typically understood to refer to living human beings. That plain meaning can be expanded when adjectives are put in front of it, so you'd have deceased person or fictitious person, but without any adjectives, it's commonly understood to refer to persons that are alive. It's also important to note that the government hasn't identified any dictionary that specifically defines the word person as including a decedent. Those dictionaries only define the word person generally as including a human being. And many of those same dictionaries, like Webster's, go on to define the word being as someone that's alive. So many state courts, like the court in Kansas and in Washington, have relied on the Webster dictionary that the government uses to conclude that in a penal statute, which is the context we're dealing with, the word person has to mean someone that's alive. Finally, the rule of lenity plays a very crucial role in this case. If there's any ambiguity, it has to be interpreted in favor of the defendant. And I think it's very difficult to conclude that the word person so unambiguously includes a decedent in the face of the plain meaning of the statute, the historical meaning at common law, and the purpose of the statute, which isn't to, in the abstract, deter identity theft. The Solicitor General's office told the Supreme Court in Flores-Figueroa that the purpose of the statute is to compensate victims whose identities are stolen. I see I'm in my rebuttal time. I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal if there are no further questions.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Ray.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Richard Ray. I'm here to represent the United States. Your Honors, the district court below committed no plain error in this case. With regard to the main issue, the issue that my opposing counsel focused on, the aggravated identity theft, the district court followed two reasoned decisions by unanimous Court of Appeals panels from other circuits. Those decisions focused on the plain text of the relevant statute, the statutory purpose, legislative history, and the statutory text context within a larger statutory provision. My opposing counsel has made many arguments, but none of them go to the fundamental points raised in the opposing courts of appeals. Moreover, certainly my opposing counsel has made no arguments as capable of demonstrating that the district court's decision was plainly erroneous in this case. Opposing counsel did mention dictionary definitions, but only one dictionary definition that opposing counsel has identified specifies the person has to be living. Other dictionaries do not so specify. Many define it simply as a human being, a human, or as an individual. Therefore, as the Eighth and First Circuits indicated, the term person here is broad enough to encompass both living and deceased persons, as is true in ordinary language. Moreover, my opposing counsel focuses on the fact that one of the purposes of this provision is to compensate for the fact that when identity theft occurs, as opposed to identity fraud, specific people are harmed. But, of course, people can be harmed even when identity theft occurs in the context of a deceased individual, the decedent's estate, the decedent's family. Moreover, that's not the only purpose of this provision. The same language appears in the A2 subprovision, which pertains to terrorism, which was introduced, as the subcommittee report on page 39 specifies, was introduced by the House in 2004, specifically in order to provide for enhanced national security. And indeed, because that same language appears in the A2 provision, it's impossible for this court to overlook the fact that national security interests would be disadvantaged by the defendant's relatively limited construction. Your Honors, if there are no further questions, thank you.
Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Block?
Yes, Your Honor. I want to make sure that the court also focuses on the second plain error that the district court made in this case. Essentially, the district court fundamentally misunderstood 1028AB3.
I think, forgive me, but I think it's you who misapprehends it, because you said that the judge should have considered the total sentence, including the consecutive two-year term for aggravated identity theft, before deciding whether to impose a non-guideline sentence on the bank fraud counts. But this, what the statute says is that the court may not consider the required two-year term in considering what sentence to impose for the predicate felony, which in this case was bank fraud.
Well, Your Honor, that's actually not what the statute says. It says that the court shall not in any way reduce the term to be imposed so as to compensate or otherwise take into account any separate term. And that otherwise take into account language is a subclause that is embedded in the shall not reduce provision of the statute. The sentencing guidelines themselves.
Oh, it sounds like what the statute is saying is first calculate the right sentence for the other crime and then add two.
The guidelines themselves, well, Your Honor, that distinction is contradicted by the guidelines themselves, which draw a distinction between reducing a sentence and refusing to enhance it. There is an identity fraud enhancement that would normally apply to the bank fraud count. But the guidelines say, because 1028A has also been charged, you shall not impose that identity fraud enhancement that you otherwise would impose. So the guidelines themselves refute the idea that that refusing to enhance the sentence is the same thing as reducing it. And the plain meaning of the text, I think, makes that clear when it specifically says, shall not in any way reduce. It doesn't talk about enhancing the sentence above the recommended guideline range. The district court here never determined that her sentence met all the goals of punishment. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Block, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.